моего папы была одна особая видеокассета на английском языке. На ней был документальный фильм под названием «Для чего мы живем» о молодых ученых и художниках в Советском Союзе, снятый в 1967 году ирландским телевидением. В этом фильме очень многие интервью и кадры были сняты в Новосибирском академгородке. Их было там даже больше, чем интервью в Москве и Ленинграде. В юности меня поражало отличие этого кино от советских и более поздних антисоветских документальных фильмов. Оптимистичный, но без всякой пропаганды, он показывал совершенно других молодых людей — космополитов, идеалистов, самостоятельно мыслящих и свободно говорящих по-английски. Сегодня они кажутся мне более современными, чем нынешняя российская молодежь. Когда мой отец умер, я захотела опубликовать этот фильм на его мемориальной странице. Для этого мне нужно было разрешение режиссерки. Так я нашла Лилию Дуан. Она ответила быстро и очень тепло. Она хорошо помнила моего отца Анатолия Бурштейна, который был одним из главных героев ее фильма. При этом они не были больше в контакте и встретились только один раз в конце 80-х в Дублине, когда мой папа, став выездным, приехал на научную конференцию. Пока я искала Дуан, я узнала о ней достаточно, чтобы мне захотелось познакомиться с ней поближе. Меня мотивировали не только ее замечательные работы, но и ее биография. Мне казалось, что я вижу параллели между тем, как она и мой отец прожили свою жизнь по разные стороны железного занавеса и сходство их личностей. У обоих очень успешный старт. В 30 лет мой отец был перспективным физиком и популярным преподавателем в одном из самых значительных институтов страны, работая с лучшими физиками своего времени в тот момент, когда зарождался Сибирский академгородок. Дуан сразу после окончания Дублинского университета, где она изучала французский и немецкий, ушла в театр. И не куда-нибудь, она проходила стажировку в Берлине у Бертольда Брехта. Оттуда она снова делает огромный шаг в другую область, участвуя в создании первого ирландского телевидения RTE, общенационального, общественного, это одна из самых старейших в мире общественных вещательных корпораций. Вскоре она возглавила и развлекательную программу, и программу новостей. Ей тоже в этот момент было чуть больше 30. Оба они оказались в нужное время и в нужном месте. Новое дело, энтузиазм, идеализм и окружение выдающихся личностей. И оба они впоследствии рискнули всем этим и своей карьерой из-за своих убеждений. Поскольку мы впервые связались с Лилией по электронной почте несколько лет назад, я погуглила, чтобы узнать, здорова ли она и по-прежнему ли она активна, и сразу же нашла новость в Irish Times. Известная режиссерка-документалистка Лилия Дулан, новатор, прокладывающий пути ирландской культуры, отмечает свой 90-й день рождения прыжком с парашютом в благотворительных целях, пишет газета. Моя сестра Майя и я встретились с ней в мае 2025 года, и это было замечательное переживание.
The first question is, was it your own idea in the first place?
Of course, the film, yes. We were making a series of films in Europe, RTE. I was working for RTE. And we were making a series of films called Into Europe because the government was planning to join the European Union, or it was called the Common Market in those days. Okay. So it was decided to make a series of 13 documentaries around Europe, and I was given the job of doing two of them. And in the course of doing, they were about small farmers and about miners, mining, and I did them in Belgium and in France, Brittany. And then I thought, since we're in Europe, why don't we do something about commemorating the revolution, the Russian Revolution, because it was 1967 and it was 50 years. And I thought, what would we do? And so I proposed to the people in RTE that we would ask a Russian television to provide us with a team to make a documentary, and in return, RTE would provide the Russian television with a team to make a documentary in Ireland. Anyway, and I wanted to make a documentary about young people and how they found society in Russia, in the Soviet Union, as it then was, 50 years later, you know, None of them was 50 years old, obviously. They were all in their early 20s or thereabouts. So that was the idea. And they negotiated, and because we were already in Europe, they said, OK, go ahead. And so that's how it came about. And we went first, and we, yeah, and that's how it came about.
OK. And how exactly did the Moscow Committee of the Radio and Television participate?
They sent a man in a dark coloured Macintosh to join the crew, who consisted of a camera woman, which was great, called Lilia, but not Lila. Anyway, and a sound man who was lovely, and that was it. There was a team of really about two, possibly occasionally a recordist as well, but and the man in the Macintosh, who was perfectly pleasant, but he was keeping a very close eye on what we wanted to shoot and who we wanted to shoot with. And I don't know where I had got. I was trying to think last night, how did we come to decide upon the people who were the young people who were going to be in the film? I must have had some kind of an advisor. This is the funny thing. I don't precisely remember exactly who it was who suggested various people. It was somebody whom I had known.
But they didn't, Moscow people and this man in Macintosh didn't advise you people to interview.
Well, the answer is I don't know.
Okay.
But I had gone myself when we were in Europe with the mining and farming program. I had just gone to Moscow and I had talked to a couple of people there, and I had made a kind of decision about where we might go. And we had decided we would go to Kyiv, Novosibirsk, Moscow, and then Leningrad, which was at that time Leningrad. And I had gone by myself.
Did you know before about Novosibirsk?
I came out of this European sort of activity, filmmaking, and I came back to Ireland, and I was given the nod to say, yes, this can be done. And then off, I got Bob Quinn, who was a colleague and a fellow director, to come with me. This was agreed. I think they thought, we need somebody to accompany her and make sure she is not kidnapped or put in jail or otherwise interfered with. Anyhow, so he came along, the two of us. And the interesting thing was, we discovered in Moscow, whenever we wanted to shoot anything like women workers on the streets or any kind of ordinary activity of human beings or photographs commemorating the revolution in the shop windows, we would say to Leila, we want a shot of this and it'll be for so long or something. And she would say, oh yeah, da-da. And your man in the Macintosh, I don't know whether he gave her a secret nod or not, but we discovered when we watched her shooting that she was not moving any film through the camera. She was just pretending to shoot the whole thing. But no film emerged of what we had desired. So as you can see, there are no pictures of the emblems that people were wearing to commemorate the revolution, of Marx or Lenin or everybody. And there were no people working on the streets. There were no... How did we decide on Novosibirsk? Was one of your questions.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it looked like we needed to have a range of people. I had wanted to have a poet or somebody in the theatre, some younger people who were students, perhaps then somebody from the sciences. And they said the best place to go is Novosibirsk. So off we went. By plane, we went everywhere by plane. The planes were like kind of buses, you know. People used them as if they were...
Smelt.
Yeah,
smelt, yeah.
Of course. Who cares? But this was the thing I hated. You know, here is the Soviet Union in which everybody is supposed to be equal. Hello? Yeah. We were put in the front of the queue, and the proletariat, namely the Russian poor sods, were left in a great heap waiting on, while we were put on board. I said, what kind of a society is this? Anyway, there you go. Yeah, so off we went to Novosibirsk, and there it was. The whole thing about the Soviet generally, because I had spent a year in Berlin before that, and East Berlin was a wasteland of horrible, grey, shocking, you know, uninteresting, huge apartment blocks. Well, Novosibirsk seemed to me to be somewhat similar. It seemed to me to be a heartless kind of a place. Anyway, we went out to the university, which seemed to be a lot livelier. And if you remember in the film, there is a man with a black beard and black hair who is a bit older than your father. Mm-hmm. And he was Tancredi Golan Polski. He was one of your father's professors. He was a character, and he was an independent kind of thinker, and he just, you know, ruled the whole place and said, we're going there, more or less, you lot, get out of the way. Well, Tancredi, I was just thought, what a bloody marvel. I don't know, was his family from Japan? I'm not certain. At all events, I liked the cut of him. Your dad was a young person who he recommended we use as somebody to speak to. And that was exactly what we did. We saw all around the university. We saw what was going on. And your dad had an interest in atomic science, I think, in particular, at that time. And I would not be a scientist, you know. I wouldn't even be much of a mathematician. But it was certainly fascinating, and Bob was also very interested in the fact that here was somebody who had, first of all, good English, great communication skills, was obviously some of our kind of people, that is to say, slightly on the margins of society. not slightly, but actually very much. Yeah. Which is where most artists live anyhow. So that was it. He was friendly, great. And he said to me, you must go down to visit my parents' dacha in Odessa. And I said, well, by God, I will certainly do that. So when we had finished the filming with the main filming with Bob and myself and this camera woman and thing and the man in the Macintosh, who was called Yuri something, I think. Anyway, I went back by myself with one cameraman from Odessa, and we filmed your dad and his parents at their dacha, and we went and filmed on the Odessa steps, the great Odessa steps from battleship Potemkin, and we also went out onto the beach and met and saw and filmed people on the beach in their beachwear, naturally, the same as it would be anywhere. And I stayed for one night in a hotel there in Odessa. And anyway, when the time came to gather up all the pieces of film and to bring it home, there was no film from Odessa. There was no film from your grandparents' dacha. All of that had conveniently been lost. Now, whether that is because your father was an unusual kind of a character or whether Novosibirsk was regarded as someplace sacred, or because he was Jewish, or because God knows what, or because they didn't want ordinary people enjoying themselves or even working on the streets, but certainly not lying around on the beach, to be seen as human beings in the Soviet Union, I don't know. All of the footage was lost, as well as a white raincoat belonging to me, which I left in the hotel, and it vanished. Anyway, that is my great memory of Odessa. But I was so glad to see the dacha of your grandparents, and your dad obviously delighted, you know, with that place, and a bit, you know, this is where they are, and they're ordinary people, and all of that kind of stuff. And then coming out onto the beach, and coming into town to the market, and just at the bottom of the steps, the great battleship Potemkin, which are, I hope they're still intact, are they?
Yeah.
Are they?
Potomaconska, yeah.
Okay, so there you are. Yeah.
How you went alone with your interview partners? For example, our father.
Yeah.
He was all his life really macho.
Yeah, he was a gamey fellow. What we would say in Ireland. This was a gamey, macho kind of a lad. Yeah, he didn't try to be gamey with me because I had Bob Quinn with me. This may have been the case. I don't know. Anyway, and I hadn't realized that we were about the same age. I'm trying to think what age. I would have been about 30.
You were the same age.
Yeah, 33. Yeah. 33, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1934, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So this, he might have said, listen, she's not for me. Anyway, who knows? The interesting about him thing was, as a scientist, he had a very broad range of interests. He was not simply engaged in the science of daily life. He was engaged in culture, in, you know, sport, I think, in theatre and drama and music and, you know, matters of the mind, which were not merely scientific, but ranged widely across a lot of different, you know, interests and you know, regimes of art and culture. Yeah.
And why this title of the film? The title is...
Oh, yeah, What Are We Living For? Because somebody said that, I think.
Ah, okay.
As somebody whom we interviewed actually said... And I thought, yeah, that's it. 50 years on from this huge revolution. What are we living for now? What did it mean? You know, both the poets and the young students and the actor expressed a kind of liveliness. And also, I mean, the whole idea of what people earned, it didn't make an awful difference because I can't remember what I earned at that time. It wasn't very much anyway. I think it might have been £1,000 a year. That'd be pounds. I've no idea. Because I think your dad earned quite well because he not only lectured, but he also did research. And between the two of those, he was able to make a proper, decent living, I think. From that point of view, what nowadays would those days have looked like to you? What would they have looked like?
I probably idealize very much this time. For me, it's the only one of two periods, short periods, democracy in Russia, or just a little bit.
Yeah.
Not real democracy, but at least a dream about it, vision about a good future, of changing something.
And when were
but
those?
I didn't
those
live...
two periods were when? When were they?
Short time in perestroika, probably
yes,
1 year
okay.
or something.
Okay. Yes, one had a sense. I mean, look.
But I can mistake, because I haven't lived there. And what you're telling about, it's not democracy at all.
No.
It was hope.
Of course it isn't democracy. But nevertheless, here is the thing that one has always to remember. It is not politicians, it is not leaders, it is not bankers who rule the world. It's human beings. It's people who work in fields. It's people who, you know, make things. It's people who are on the bloody job day after day. That's what makes the bloody world go around, not a bunch of stupid idiots who believe that they are politically running things, when in actual fact, they're not. They're pretending. But that isn't true just of us. In Ireland, it's everywhere. Well, it's more than everywhere at the moment. It is a shocking world that we live in now. It was a little less shocking in the mid to late 60s. 66, around... It was a little bit more optimistic. You know, there was a bit of hope. Now, I don't think the Soviet Union was a hotbed of hope, you know. I think it was probably... People were hanging on as poor people do, everywhere, you know. It's not just in Ireland or Russia or America that poor people hang on. It's everywhere, around the whole world. Sorry for banging on your thing. Anyway, there you are. I'd be opinionated. I'm a very opinionated person. You've got to understand that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. No. Well, see what else you must know.
Probably only one, if this work on this movie change your views in some way. That you came
it changed my health.
Disappointed.
I'll tell you what, it changed my health. What I did not realize when I was making the film is that I am a celiac. That means I am allergic to gluten in barley, wheat, rye, and oats. When I was in Russia, so did I love rye bread that I ate rye bread and I drank borscht until it came out my ears. And when I came home, I became very, very, very ill. I had to go to hospital. And they did all kinds of investigations, but they didn't do the important one, which was done 20 years later and did establish that I was a celiac. And if I touch rye, I become so ill that it's awful. So that's my memory of Russia. No, and they didn't even diagnose what was wrong with me. Anyway, and it didn't matter because I'm basically healthy, as you can see. So I just kept going. Yeah, that's it. So that was my a sense of which I had begun to have in East Berlin was more or less, it was emphasized even more in the Soviet Union. There was a kind of air of coldness, no great warmth between people that I could see. A lot of drinking, a lot of heavy drinking. Well, we are great drinkers in Ireland as well. But at least the Irish have a sense of the silliness of life, of the humour of life, and of the irony of life. And it was hard to get a feeling for that in the Soviet Union at that time, as it was in East Berlin, which would have been 10 years earlier. I was there when the wall was in place in East Berlin, and I was there when the wall came down in 89. That was the perestroika time. So it was interesting from that point of view to see the contrast between people being regimed by the system and people having a certain freedom. That's it. I'm addicted to freedom. So there you are. That's it.
What you would say are qualities absolutely need to have?
What qualities do people
absolutely need to have?
Well, I can't dictate.
But it's your
humor. Thing. Humor, kindness, integrity, honesty. And resourcefulness, you know, risk-taking. People need to take a risk. That's really what people need to be able to do. It's you know, life is so unexpected anyhow that you might as well take a risk on something. I've been taking risks most of my life. Many of them have been a disaster. Some of them have not been a disaster. Some of them have been great fun. But I have enjoyed. Let us say enjoyment is one of the most important qualities any human being can possess. Enjoyment of life, of other people, of nature, of the world, of the fact that this is ridiculous. I mean, it is people, human beings living in this world, it is a proposition which is utterly without any intelligence. You know, why? What the hell are we doing here? Jesus Christ, you wonder. Oh, my God, I haven't a clue. I haven't a notion. So you just go on day to day. You plant things. You see your friends. You go about. You try to do bits of work that are, you hope, useful. Get an insight into what's happening. Listen, it's mostly all fiction.
Как же развивались дальше биографии Лилии Дуан и моего отца? Как я уже говорила, оба они рискнули своей профессиональной карьерой. Анатолий Бурштейн был не только популярным лектором, но и основателем и президентом клуба под интегралом. Это было общественное пространство не только для того, чтобы потанцевать под джаз, но также для публичных дебатов, что, кстати, уже можно увидеть в фильме «Дулан». На следующий год после съемок фильма «Интеграл» организовал фестиваль запрещенных и полузапрещенных авторских песен. Это было воспринято московской прессой и городскими властями как беспрецедентный диссидентский акт. Зал был переполнен. Записи песен, в том числе полный концерт Александра Галича, разошлись по всей стране. А у организаторов, особенно у моего отца, возникли большие проблемы. Его будущее как ученого оказалось под угрозой. Шел 1968 год. Вскоре российские войска вторглись в Чехословакию. Анатолий Бурштейн, по его словам, не веря больше в будущее своей страны, с этого момента замкнулся в науке и семье. Несмотря на репрессии и серьезные попытки сорвать защиту его диссертации, в 1969 году он получил звание профессора. Бурштейн опубликовал сотни научных статей и 8 книг. Но только после перестройки он смог ответить на приглашение принимать участие в международных научных конференциях и ездить по всему миру в качестве профессора. В 90-х он смог также напечатать свои публицистические эссе. Например, о сходстве коммунизма и христианства, коммунизм – наше светлое прошлое, об антисемитизме в Советском Союзе, одиссея советского еврея и о подлинной истории клуба под интегралом, возвращение интеграла, о том, какие последствия она имела для ученых и почему этот фестиваль, тем не менее, был нужен. В 1991 году он стал профессором и консультантом на кафедре химической физики в научном институте Вайцмана в Израиле, где работал до конца своей жизни. Его личность, его убеждения никогда не изменились. Он не пытался приспособиться к тоталитарной системе, колеблющемуся общественному мнению, к духу времени. То же самое, очевидно, можно сказать и о Лилии Дулан. Лилия Дулан была одна из трех ведущих продюсеров, которые демонстративно покинули RTE в 1969 году из-за своих взглядов на роль государственного телевидения и в знак протеста против политической и коммерческой предвзятости RTE. В книге «Садитесь, и вас пересчитают» они выразили свое возмущение и несогласие охотой за рейтингами и давлением, которая оказывала реклама на создание программ и вообще на облик телевидения. Дулан вместе со своими коллегами путешествовал по стране, организуя встречи населения и дебаты, где обсуждалось, каким должно быть общественное телевидение, какова его роль. Вскоре она стала художественным руководителем самого знаменитого ирландского театра «Эбби», первой женщиной в этой роли. А еще через пару лет она бросила все это и начала заново учиться культурной антропологии в Белфастском университете, где она защитила докторскую диссертацию об элементах сакрального и драматического в урбанных анклавах Белфаста. В этих же анклавах она параллельно занималась созданием коммунального общественного видео. Лилия Дулан также была создателем и куратором международного кинофестиваля в Голве, где представлены художественные документальные фильмы, инноваторские работы начинающих и фильмы известных кинорежиссеров со всего мира. В 77 лет она сняла документальный фильм «Бернадетт. Заметки о политическом путешествии», посвященный Бернадетт Девлин Маккеллински, женщине-политику и социалистке, которая представляла Северную Ирландию в британском парламенте, была, кстати, самым юным членом британского парламента за его историю, известной как Жанна де Арк Северной Ирландии. Дулан получила за него премию за лучший документальный фильм на конкурсе ирландского кино и телевидения. В своей речи по этому поводу она сказала:
And the message is simple. Keep singing, keep cherishing, feisty, rebellious, awkward, difficult people. That's what we're about. Cherish uncertainty, cherish failure, cherish poverty, cherish ourselves. Thank you.